Today is Wednesday, December 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. House of Representatives is now debating two articles of impeachment against U.S. President Donald Trump.
The president, a successor to the same office as George Washington and Abraham Lincoln, betrayed his oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. These aren't opinions. These are uncontested facts.
We'll take a look at the significance of today in American politics. Plus a whole lot more. All these stories are coming up next. The U.S. House of Representatives is expected to vote in favor of impeaching U.S. President Donald Trump late Wednesday, making him the third president in the country's history to face an impeachment trial and the potential punishment of being removed from office. The House, according to rules adopted on Tuesday, will spend 6 hours debating the impeachment articles that accuse Trump of abusing the powers of the presidency by soliciting Ukraine's interference in the 2020 U.S. election and of obstructing Congress by defying subpoenas seeking testimony and documents as lawmakers investigated the matter. Democratic Congressman Jim McGovern says the impeachment case against President Trump is a democracy-defining moment.
The president, a successor to the same office as George Washington and Abraham Lincoln, betrayed his oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. These aren't opinions. These are uncontested facts.
A vote is expected in the evening. Around the same time, Trump is scheduled to be speaking at a campaign rally in the state of Michigan. Anti-Trump protesters rallied in several cities across the United States on Tuesday, and VOA's Michael Sullivan has that story.
In New York, Los Angeles, and other U.S. cities, protesters said they want Trump out of office. The country is closely divided over impeaching and removing Trump, but this protester wants to hear the evidence.
Trump is entitled to all the due process he wants. He should just show up and testify.
As Congress moves toward a vote in the House of Representatives, where Democrats dominate, these protesters want to make their voices heard.
There's strength in numbers, hopefully.
More than 40% of Americans agree with President Trump that the impeachment hearings are politically motivated. Conviction in the Senate is not likely because the president's Republican allies hold a majority there. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
And joining us on the phone right now to take a broader look at the significance of what is about to take place in the House of Representatives and in the American political scheme is David Barrett, political science professor at Villanova University. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Steve. Thank you.
Well, this is something that's only happened, a couple of times in American history. So I wanted to kind of step back and have you explain why this is so significant of what's taking place today.
Well, very few presidents have ever been impeached, and really, although the formal vote doesn't happen until early evening today, there's no doubt what's going to happen, which is that Donald J. Trump will be impeached by the House of Representatives on two articles of impeachment. And it happened to President Andrew Johnson in the 19th century, and he is one of those presidents with a quite poor reputation. It was about to happen to President Nixon, but he resigned, and his reputation in history is not very good, mixed at best. It happened to President Clinton, and I think there hasn't been enough passage of time to see how that will affect him, but I think it's certainly not a good mark on his record. So President Trump knows that. He himself says the word impeachment is an ugly word. And it's now going to be one of those words that is attached to his presidency.
So if we take a look at American politics, you mentioned President Johnson, staring in the face of impeachment. Mr. Nixon was able to get around it by resigning offices. But in the last 50 years or so, we've had three presidents face impeachment. What does that say about American politics, given that this is a relatively young country of a couple of centuries?
Well, it is suggestive, certainly. You could make a case that it's suggestive of the tremendous partisanship in U.S. politics. But I'm not sure I'd buy into that, because when we look, we scholars and journalists try to be objective. When one looks at the behavior of President Nixon, I think pretty objectively speaking, what he did was obstruction of justice. There's still controversy about whether what President Clinton did rose to the level of impeachment, but it was bad behavior, you know. And I would say that phone call that President Trump had with the leader of Ukraine, this is not one of the better moments of his presidency. I think it's hard not to see that he's doing something there for his political gain. So, yes, we are in a more partisan era than, say, the pre-Nixon, pre-Watergate era. But it's also a lesson to presidents, which, to be honest, I think says, you know, watch out. You can't. There are things that you cannot do. So that's my read.
So we have the vote taking place this evening, and then right. Congress goes into recess. You know, we're moving into 2020, a presidential election year. You know, the full House is going to be, you know, reselected again, voted upon, a third of the Senate. What do you anticipate moving into 2020, January, when the Senate is expected to take up this measure? What's that going to have on the American population as they look at entering an election year?
I think the safest estimate is to say that it actually is not going to have a tremendous effect on public opinion. We've seen with this particular presidency a real stability in his standing with the public, which is to say, of the people who support him, there's a lot of enthusiasm, and among the people who do not support him, who oppose him, there's also intense opposition. And, you know, sometimes I see headlines about polls to say, oh, you know, his popularity is up and his popularity is down. But honestly, if you look at sort of the long run of the whole of his presidency and his standing with the public, it's pretty stable. And, you know, we had some dramatic, or the House, specifically the Intelligence Committee, had some very dramatic testimony. And there was a question in my mind as to whether that would significantly move public opinion, but that seems not to have happened. Again, you can see some cases here and there that were suggestive of it, but when you look at his overall standing with the public, it's pretty much the same. His, by that I mean the president's standing.
David Barrett is a political science professor at Villanova University. Thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Steve.
Seven Democratic presidential candidates will take the stage in Los Angeles on Thursday in the party's sixth debate of the nominating contest for the November 2020 election. The debate will be held on the campus of Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. The eight other candidates in the Democratic field of 15 failed to qualify this time as the primary contest early next year draw closer. The four top contenders continue to be Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Pete Buttigieg. But analysts say keeping an eye on Andrew Yang, the young entrepreneur who just barely qualified for this debate. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres stressed Tuesday that the international community should take action against the root causes of refugee problems and reestablish respect for refugees. Speaking at a press conference during the ongoing Global Refugee Forum, Guterres said it is the time to ensure that the human rights of refugees are upheld, to reestablish the integrity of the international refugee protection regime, and to address the problems that led people to flee in the first place. Guterres said the global forced displacement has been rising steadily in recent years, and the growth is outpacing at the rate of the solutions are being found. Filippo Grandi, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, was optimistic about the forum thus far.
And I think the response we got around this forum is quite impressive. There's 3,000 participants registered. For UNHCR, this is the biggest event it has ever managed in its history. So it's quite significant. We estimate that there's about 700 pledges. And when I say pledges, it doesn't mean only money. There's many ways that actors, participants can pledge.
Now, for more on the conference, I spoke to VOA's Heather Murdoch, who's in Geneva.
At this forum, the UN Secretary General spoke yesterday talking about why they're having it. And what he said was that there are now 70 million people who were forcibly displaced from their homes on this earth, and that's twice as much as there were 20 years ago. And the issue, the overreaching issue that they're trying to address is that currently the number of refugees and other displaced people is growing faster than the humanitarian community's ability to address the problems and find solutions for people.
This conference is incredibly large in spoke. I heard Felipe Grande and Antonio Guterres, when they were speaking on Tuesday, say there's something like 3,000 participants.
Yes, there are 3,000 people here, including 60 people who are actually refugees, which is a small number, but they tell me that last time they had a conference any similar to this last year, they only had two people who were refugees attending. But among the 3,000 people, besides humanitarian actors like the United Nations and other large international NGOs, there's also representatives of governments from around the world and representatives from the private sector, and organizations like the World Bank.
As you mentioned, there's 70 million people who are displaced or refugees right now, and this is the impetus for this conference and this summit. What is the United Nations really trying to achieve as a deliverable from this meeting?
What they're trying to do is obtain pledges from countries and from private organizations and other aid organizations for things like additional aid. From countries, Western countries, they're asking for additional spaces for people that want to resettle. That's one huge problem they face, is that many people would happily, legally resettle in third countries and safe countries, except there's not enough places granted by the governments in the countries they want to go to. They're also trying to encourage governments that host a lot of refugees to change some policies to allow refugees to have access to work and education. And one thing that they're trying to also stress is that most of the refugees in the world live in developing countries. So these countries have an overwhelming of refugees and have less resources to give them. So the UNHCR and the United Nations is trying to encourage rich countries to do more to alleviate the burden for poorer countries that are hosting most of the refugees.
And that was VOA's own Heather Murdoch speaking to me in Geneva. South Korea and the United States failed on Wednesday to reach an agreement over Seoul's contribution toward hosting 28,500 U.S. troops, ending 2 days of talks that were the last before their existing deal expires on December the 31st. U.S. President Donald Trump has accused South Korea of being a rich nation that profits off the U.S. military forces, which are stationed in the country as a legacy of the 1950 to 1953 Korean War and has been there facing continued threats from North Korea. South Korean lawmakers have said Washington is seeking up to $5 billion a year to support the troops, more than five times the amount Seoul has paid this year. That's something the U.S. denies and said that their final negotiated number will be lower than whatever the initial request was. The next set of talks will be in the United States in January, with the exact timing still to be determined. You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
According to a new study published in the Astronomical Journal, about 3.5 million years ago, which on a galactic scale is quite recent, there was a colossal explosion of energy at the center of the Milky Way. The explosion, which scientists call a Seyfert flare, sent out powerful cone-shaped beams of radiation that sliced through our galaxy and a good distance into deep space. The researchers say the flare was so powerful that it affected the Magellanic Stream some 200,000 light years from the Milky Way. Study authors who used data from the Hubble Space Telescope to make their findings estimate the blast lasted for about 300,000 years. The research team behind the study says this explosion was too enormous to have been set off by anything other than nuclear activity associated with the supermassive black hole at the center of the Milky Way, known as Sagittarius A star. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. India's top court on Wednesday refused to stall the implementation of a new law that lays out a path for non-Muslim minorities from some neighboring countries for Indian citizenship. That is despite violent protests across the country. Reuters' Francis McGuire has that story.
India's top court refused to stall a new law on Wednesday. Has prompted violent protests across the country. The Citizenship Amendment Act gives non-Muslim minorities from neighboring countries Pakistan, Bangladesh and Afghanistan a path to Indian citizenship. The government says the law was intended to address the persecution of religious minorities such as Hindus, Sikhs and Christians in those Muslim-majority countries. But thousands have protested, saying the exclusion of Muslims from the law is anti-Islam and weakens the secular foundations of India. Some protesters believe it's a measure by the Hindu nationalist government to marginalise the community. Buses and train stations have been torched, and on Wednesday police fired shots to push back thousands of demonstrators throwing stones and glass bottles. The Supreme Court said it would hear petitions challenging the constitutional validity of the law on January 22nd.
And that was Reuters reporter Francis McGuire. In a new report published on Tuesday, Human Rights Watch sharply criticized Israel's use of military orders to repress Palestinians in the West Bank. Linda Gradstein reports it says Israel often suspends civil rights, including the right to speak out, report news, or be politically active.
In the report, Human Rights Watch says Israel must grant more civil rights to Palestinians living in the West Bank. The report's author, Omar Shakir, said Israel imposed these repressive laws in 1967 when it took over the West Bank.
The wording is so vague that people have been detained for Facebook posts, peaceful protests, and meetings among activists.
Shakir spoke from Jordan since Israel deported him last month for his support of the movement known as Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS. The movement calls for boycotting Israel and all products made there. He says Israel is applying two different legal standards to people living next to each other.
Now, these policies only apply to the 2.5 million Palestinians in the West Bank, not the more than 400,000 Israeli settlers who live beside them. So in some cases, you have people on one side of the road who enjoy civil rights, while people on the other side of the road do not.
One of the cases in the report is that of Farid al-Atrash, a human rights activist detained by Israel at a protest in 2016. The activist says it is his right to say no to the occupation and to injustice and to take part in peaceful protests. Israeli military officials have rejected the report's conclusion. They say Israel does not stop Palestinians from participating in peaceful protests if the demonstrators have a permit, but that such events are held with no permit and can become violent. They also say Israel follows international law, which allows for trials of Palestinians in military courts for security offenses. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Japan has demanded the prompt release of the crews of five fishing vessels detained by Russia, saying that they were doing nothing wrong and calling them to be set free on humanitarian grounds. Russian border guards seized the fishing vessels near Russian-held islands that Japan claims. It came while Japanese Foreign Minister Toshimitsu Motegi is visiting Russia, seeking to restart stalled negotiations over the islands and a formal peace treaty to formally end World War II. Chief Cabinet Secretary Yoshihide Suga said the ships were fishing for octopus near four islands when they were taken by Russian ships for investigations on suspicion they had violated fishing agreements. Japan claims the four Russian-held islands off Japan's northern region of Hokkaido and calls them the Northern Territories. Known in Russia as the Southern Kuriles, the islands were invaded by the then-Soviet army in the waning days of World War II. The islands' row has prevented Russia and Japan from signing a formal truce treaty ending the Second World War. Tourists expressed disappointment Wednesday over the cancellation of Hong Kong's popular New Year's Eve fireworks due to security concerns amid more than 6 months of protests. VOA's Jeff Custer has more.
The fireworks usually draw thousands of residents and tourists to the picturesque Victoria Harbor, and the countdown is broadcast worldwide. Jose Gading from the Philippines says he was disappointed by the news.
As a tourist, I'm kind of sad because I think it's every year that the people are expecting the New Year festival or anything. But then I do understand if it is for the safety of everyone. So I think it's good. It's better to postpone or cancel it.
Sparked by a controversial and now withdrawn extradition bill, the ongoing protests in the former British colony have crippled the tourism and retail sectors. Several high-profile cultural and sporting events have been canceled in recent months. Tourism officials say the fireworks will be replaced with a Symphony of Lights, a multimedia light show involving projections on the city's tallest skyscrapers at the stroke of midnight. The facade of the waterside Hong Kong Convention and Exhibition Center will be turned into a giant countdown clock. Lucia, a tourist from Argentina, thinks the decision may have an impact.
But I believe maybe it's not going to be like good for the tourism. It's going to affect the tourists. But on the other hand, I think it's, I don't know if the town, I mean, is expecting the fireworks because it's a custom and a tradition. It's not good for them either. I don't think the protesters are going to be affected like emotionally. They're going to keep on protesting, I believe. So, yeah.
The Hong Kong Tourism Board said tourist arrivals in Hong Kong plunged 56% in the past year, the steepest fall since the outbreak of severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS, 15 years ago. Other events to be canceled include the Hong Kong Football Club Rugby Section's annual Rugby Tens Tournament, scheduled to be held in April, and Clock and Flap, one of Asia's biggest music festivals, which was scrapped last month. Hong Kong sank into recession for the first time in a decade in the third quarter of this year. Jeff Custer, VOA News.
1 in 5 U.S. high school students vaped marijuana in the past year, and its popularity has been booming faster than nicotine vaping. The AP's Sherry Adler has more.
The University of Michigan survey was sponsored by the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Dr. Wilson Compton is their deputy director.
Putting chemicals directly into your lungs is dangerous for lung health and may have long-term consequences on brain development and other really significant health concerns.
And while marijuana vaping use was up, there was some good news in the survey about teen opioid use.
The message around the dangers and the reduced overall prescribing by physicians has led to marked reductions in use of Vicodin, OxyContin, and the other prescription opioids.
Survey results have been published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. I'm Shelley Adler.
Australia experienced its hottest day on record, and temperatures are expected to soar even higher as a heat wave embraces most of the country. The Australian Bureau of Meteorology said the average temperature across the country was 40.9 degrees Celsius, and that beat a record of 40.3 Celsius set on January 7, 2013. Dean Namore of the Bureau of Meteorology described the record temperatures as incredible.
These national average maximum temperature records, you normally only break them by just a very small margin, but we broke the previous one back in January 13 by 0.6 of a degree, and there's a good chance that we could see that fall again today, and even more likely tomorrow as well, as we see huge areas of the country expecting not only above 40 degree temperatures, but also widespread areas above 45 degrees through many parts of western New South Wales, almost all of South Australia, and then parts of the Northern Territory and Southwest Queensland as well. So an incredible pool of hot air sitting right across the country at the moment.
Now, the Weather Bureau said temperatures in southern and central Australia on Thursday may reach between 8 and 16 degrees higher than normal. On Wednesday, temperatures soared to 47.7 Celsius in Birdsville, Queensland, 46.9 in Mandurah, Western Australia, and similar levels across southern and central Australia. The highest temperature reliably recorded at any location in Australia was 50.7 degrees centigrade in January 1960. Cooler conditions are forecast from Friday. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our exceptional team on the other side of the glass, Nadia Taha, our director and producer, engineer Thomas Blondet, and managing editor Kate Pound Dawson, thank you very much for joining us. You'll be able to keep up with news and world events on our website. And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.